This is the second of our evening forums around the general topic of religion and health. This one is focused on mental health, religion and mental illness and mental well-being. This is a very large topic. We are going to ramble for a few minutes, and then you will be able to ramble for more minutes. There are lots of different questions in this area, and I don't want to arbitrarily focus ourselves on one rather than the other. But let me just throw in one cautionary note at the beginning. The whole notion of mental illness is under serious dispute among academics in the area, not necessarily by the majority of them, but at least by a distinct minority. And the charge is often made that our categories of mental illness should more appropriately be categories of social malfunction or social misfit than mental illness. Whether that charge sticks in most cases or in all cases is, of course, the debate. Let me, however, just throw out an example in my own experience that brought the at least plausibility of the charge that notions of mental illness are really social categories instead of medical ones, real illness. One usually thinks of a manic depressive as a pretty classic case of someone who is mentally ill. For one thing, the particular this particular problem is treatable by drugs, lithium, I believe. And usually that is, in many, many cases, that treatment is successful. So of all mental illnesses, this seems to be one that fits fairly clearly the medical model and one which we should call an illness. Well, it struck me in one case that a person who was a fairly clear manic depressive was perhaps having really just a social problem. The person was, to be sure, very depressed at times. The person was also manic at other times. But the thing that was driving the person into depression, perhaps, one could argue, is the fact that when this person was manic, our society wasn't built to handle him. There was no way this person in the manic stage could operate in our society and be accepted. And because he couldn't be accepted in his manic stage, he would fall into depression. Now, I'm sure there's a physiological basis to what was going on, but nevertheless, it caused me to ask the question whether or not, in some very significant sense, the cause of the illness wasn't our society and our society's inability to accept this person in his manic stage. Well, with that caveat, let us go on with the program. Two people will present some things from their experience in counseling. One, Karen Granberg-Michelson, is a counselor with Lutheran Social Services. The other, Joe Vaughn, is a clinical psychologist. They will bring to our discussion some initial remarks, and then we will open it up for wider discussion. Karen? Oh, Joe's
Joe?
Not here. I'm sorry.
Thought that maybe one way to begin a discussion would be to present some pros and cons in relation to how the church might have a positive or negative effect on this thing that we call mental illness, social maladjustment, personal difficulties, emotional distress. My card here says the church's contribution to emotional distress. And I'd like to speak to about seven or eight ways in which the church contributes to emotional distress in people. These are not just my ideas, but also taken from a book by William Miller entitled Why Do Christians Break Down? So I'm going to present some of the con, I guess, and Karen's going to speak to some of the positive ways that the church might contribute to emotional health. In my view, and in Miller's view, that one of the cons here, and one of the ways in which the church does contribute to the emotional distress of people, whether we call it illness or social deviancy, is that is in a perpetuation of a kind of doctrine in the church which says that if a person really has faith, is truly a Christian, he will have none of these kinds of difficulties, doubts, fears, hang-ups, concerns, questions. Christians should bear up under all adversity. Conversely, too often the presentation, the message from the church is if we do have these things, that somehow our faith is not strong enough. Second point would be that there's in the church a tendency to stifle the expression of real personal feelings, especially anger, and instead substitute for those a consistent, neutral pleasantness by which we meet other people and meet the world that isn't really, that's very proper, but that isn't really very reflective of how we function as individuals and of the wide spectrum of feelings that all of us experience. Third, the church tends to stress a kind of false personal security and goodness by emphasizing denial and repression of the darker problem side, the shadow side, Jung called it, of persons' needs and feelings. The church tends to kind of push that down and in a sense, not allow it to come to or to be in existence. Four, another concern would be that through a kind of legalism and authoritarianism, there are oppressive behavioral expectations of people communicated through the church, including things like you must, you ought, you should. Those kinds of commands creating a great deal of anxiety and guilt among people beyond what we should reasonably experience. And at the same time, the church has also stressed, in a sense, the worthless, sinful nature of man. It has also exhorted its members to superhuman behavior and perfection. The church is really asking us, the church is focusing on the negative side, and it's also asking us in that focus to somehow strive for perfection. Six, that there's a focus on being ashamed of oneself, rather than a positive sense of self that comes out of many of our church's orientations. Seven, too often the church has become a private club, creating cliques, in-groups and out-groups, accepting only certain kinds of people, that the deviance of our society, that the hurting and the pain, the people in pain in our society are not allowed in, but rather kept on the outside, and that there is a kind of friction between non-acceptance of others and of other denominations who also make up the body. I'm reminded of a quote that the churches should not be a hotel for saints, but it is a hospital for sinners. Too often, I think, we make of it and we communicate to others that it is a hotel for saints. Last, that the church tends to paint things in black and white, right and wrong, judgmental terms with little consideration for the specific situation. That we don't have an awareness in many instances in the church's part of the kinds of areas in between. Those would be some of the ways in which William Miller in his book talks about the church as contributing to emotional illness, some of the ways in which I've seen also. I'd like to just end my little segment with an example. I saw a man in psychotherapy for several years suffering from chronic depression. This was a man who had been the president of his congregation. This was a man who had been active in his church. This is a man who had not experienced any significant family, physical or emotional difficulties for most of his life. When he experienced his first depressive episode and it required hospitalization in the psychiatric unit in the Rockford community, this man received one visit from his pastor and no contacts from the other members of his church. He subsequently spent several months in the hospital and was released from the hospital, and upon being released from the hospital and entering therapy, stopped attending church because of his feeling that he had given to his congregation, to his church, and that in his time of need, that they were not available to him, nor did they take the opportunity to seek him out and to comfort or contribute to any healing. It's those kinds of examples that make me believe that there are many ways in which the church contributes to mental distress.
That's a hard act to follow. I'll make a transition using Paul Tournier. I've referred to him a lot this week. The book that I have been using is Whole Person in a Broken World, especially the chapter called The Task of the Church. And for the purposes of transition, I want to quote Tournier as saying, "It was the inner division of the church and its faults which contributed most to the modern person's estrangement from Christianity," just to underscore Joe's comments. But then to flip over into the question, really, that Tournier is raising is also my question. Do you have any other solution for the injustices of the world except the power of Christ? This power which can make a Christian as well as an unbeliever examine him or herself, which can compel us to acknowledge our offenses and make amends for them. So I think the comments that I would want to make about the church or the koinonia, the fellowship of the believers, would be more from the angle of the church's potential. There's no question that Christ gave the church the charism of healing for its use. The question is how much churches are able to appropriate this in practical life. Joe has presented, you know, a rather bleak picture of what happens, and I have to say that as people enter my door for counseling, I see a lot of church people, and I really see more casualties of the church than I do positive testimonies. But I do know of a few positive testimonies, and I'll tell you what I think they're based on. First would be that I think in some churches there is, in fact, a humility factor, an honestness factor, that some fellowships have achieved a maturity which allows them to have a baseline that all of us have sinned and come short of God's glory, and so welcome in, sister or brother. We, you know, here we all are, and let's accept one another. I think this is rare, but it does happen. I think another thing that it's just another way of stating that is that some churches have learned, with at least limited success, how to be really hospitable and more of a home for the heart. I can think of a vivid example of a young woman who came to Sojourners Fellowship. Well, just very young, kind of fresh out of college, with just many, many immaturities. It's hard to be very specific, so maybe this isn't going to be a very meaningful example. This person was very insecure and very dependent on approval and really didn't have any sense of herself separate from someone else, didn't know a lot about her belief system. And over a period of years, parallel to a course maybe of psychotherapy, but simply in the context of the fellowship of this particular believing community, this person made tremendous gains and came to a sense of clarity and self-identity and real creative expression. She became a dancer and taught the whole community how to worship through dance. And again, I feel like I'm just kind of floundering around here, but I've seen the power of community life or the life of a living fellowship on a member. I think I should really just end there because I don't think I can come up with four more. So maybe I could think of it as we go along.
Are there comments, questions people have about the relationship of religion, churches, both, and mental health?
I would like to comment about the man who didn't return to his church. It seems to me that there is a great deal of judgment being rendered by members of almost any church that I've been in. And I've been a Lutheran all of my life, and I've lived in about 12 different towns. They sort of take it upon themselves to judge the parishioner. I don't know how you get past this, but I wonder if it's because they're being defensive. Because any new idea that you suggest is apt to be met with, oh, we don't do that in our church. And this is pretty hard. And if you persist and stay in the church, and we've learned to do this, you eventually overcome some of it. But it takes some real guts to hang in there and do it. And you feel like, why am I knocking my head against a wall trying to get some of these things done? But eventually they start working. And it's not because it's a great idea, but it's because we've experienced it in other churches and how well it works. So I wonder if it's because people are defensive and they don't want change, or whether they're judging you by their own past experiences. And how do you go about changing it other than what we've been able to do in a few instances?
I wonder if what you're talking about in terms of both the affirmation and the destructiveness of a group could in some ways equally be attributed to the Kiwanis Club or the Rotary or the Serapis or whatever, that people have those experiences in various kinds of groups, not necessarily the church, and both sides.
Well, I think the big difference between the Seroptimus or the Rotary and the church is that the church was particularly assigned the charism of healing. And I don't know about those other bodies. But those who understand themselves as the church certainly have that responsibility. I was thinking about what you were saying, and I was thinking how far most churches have strayed from a picture that at least psychologist O.H. Maurer draws of the early church. His impression is that why the early church spread with such enthusiasm was because people committed to live openly with one another, to make, to have confession, to make restitution wherever possible, and to, you know, just live committed to a real level of honesty. I can't account for why this has become such a rare experience, except for fear, I guess, fear and self-protectiveness. But it seems like those of us who feel like this is what it will take to make the church a real healing community need to probably just try to model it more, the best, and I mean, as failingly as we do, just still need to try to kind of, you know, it's the old put out what you want to get back scene.
Yes?
I wonder if one of the reasons we have problems with helping people in the church is because we are so big and we do so many things in a big group. We go to a big lecture, or we go to a service, and it seems to me that part of the answer is small groups where you get to know each other, whether it's a prayer group or a Bible study or a book meeting, or someplace where there's a sharing within each other so that people have responsibility for someone else. You know, if you have a whole church and you hear one person's ill, unless you happen to know that person, it doesn't always affect you, or else you think somebody else is going to take care of them.
Our experiences were almost the opposite. Like of this, the congregation was about 50 people, and that was more of a social clique than I think a larger congregation that we were faced with. It was mostly older people that I felt, own the church, and they did things this way, that way, and it was just very hard to to get into to new things. And there's just a group of, they sat at the same place every Sunday. And it was a small group. And I didn't think that would be good.
It almost seems like we're at odds. In other words, that the whole act isn't pulled together in churches. That there is a feeling that they do want to have more members come in, to keep the church alive and so on. But it's like everybody doesn't know what the program is, because the members that are already in the church, it seems like they're very zealous. For instance, I went to a church for a good many years, and no one ever talked to me. And I've thought about this a lot since, because now when I see somebody in the church, and this one woman, this is an example, but she said that she had gone to the church 7 years, and I was the first person that spoke to her that actually went and made an effort. Now, you have to do more in churches than just come and sit in a pew. People have to reach out to you, and it is very clicky in churches. And I'm like this lady too. I grew up a Lutheran, and have been in several different Lutheran churches. And I'm really nervy. I mean, I don't exactly need someone, but you do feel shut out, because if you don't know the ropes. I'm now president of my congregation, and believe me, my byword is communication, because I think the worst enemy in the church congregations is the fact we don't communicate with each other. We get new members in, and inside of a month, nobody knows who they are or what happened to them. No one is actually assigned to saying, keep tab of that person and call and invite them. They say, well, they know the church is here, is always the attitude. Of course. But I think most people need to be reached out to on a person-to-person basis. Communication is my byline. And I don't know, but I can see how this council, this president, I guess it was your story, that I imagine if I dropped by the wayside tomorrow, no one would probably know I had been there as council president inside of 2 months, Because there's more of them going away frustrated than staying around afterwards to continue the role of what's happening in the church. And I think we all comfort ourselves in the fact that, sure, I believe strongly, I have the faith in everything, but we're human enough, so we need the interplay, the interrelationship with other people. We want other people to be part of this too, and I don't think we're going to gain people to come to the fold unless we actually reach out on a personal basis, and the pastor cannot do it all. It's got to be the people of the church. It cannot be a clique. It is a clique outfit.
If I could introduce a different sort of slant here. Elizabeth O'Connor talks in some of her books about a needed education for a new society, meaning us, the church, that part of the problem is that we all come out of our nuclear family experience, and we all have a certain system and way of relating, whether it was successful or unsuccessful or a mixture. I think when I've tried to assess why do people hurt so much about their negative church experiences, it sometimes occurs to me that it's because it's a mirror or a repeat of that first ambiguous relationship in the home, and that perhaps what it might take in part to build a church that really does function like a fellowship of believers and fellowship of the beloved would be to say, well, we need to raise our consciousnesses and be educated for how to be new people in Christ. And so, and in other words, you can take that on and on and on, but how would we relate differently to one another in the church if we were trying to relate adult to adult, not kid to parent, and as new people in Christ?
And there's always that division between those that were there and those that are new coming in. Because if there's a large family, like three generations in a family or something, that's in the church, which wasn't my case at all, but then they are very zealous about keeping that. And we, and anyone new feels like they're breaking into something And yet here they've been invited to join. They've taken the instructions and everything, and they're entitled to it. It's almost like they have to serve their apprenticeship to be considered welcome and to be invited to be part of any of the other things. And I think this can be very demoralizing to people, and a lot of them drop by the wayside within a year.
Let me go back a minute to an earlier point. The question was asked whether or not isn't in fact a possibility that the church is like some other community groups and a function of the same kinds of situations when people band together and thus exclude at times or make mistakes or judge others. I wonder if that's really the case, though. I wonder if the church isn't supposed to be doing a different kind of thing, as Karen suggests, but I wonder also if there aren't other problems inherent in the church structure that are very much different from a community group. In other words, one of the things that we're talking about here from Miller's point of view is what about the kind of guilt that's engendered in a situation where we are told and we are focused on as sinful, unclean, negative kinds of people, and yet asked to respond and to be something else again in our walk in faith. What about a situation or a group situation like in a church where certain kinds of people are rejected because of the way in which they might behave or because of the way in which they might be different than somebody else? What about a situation where a church or some churches don't allow certain kinds of feelings, certain kinds of expressions, and don't teach how we can express all of those as people? Aren't those different kinds of issues than just another community group? Aren't we dealing with a different kind of situation here? Not just where a church might exclude somebody, but where a church might create and contribute to difficulties for people in the emotional realm.
Is the reason because the religious dimension of the church as a social organization harbors a greater personal psychological dependence of the individual upon it? It's more likely to be a crutch than a Kiwanis Club. Whether it's a good crutch or a bad crutch, of course, would vary.
That would be an option. I think also that we have built-in expectations for one another in the church that come partly out of Scripture, and so that's a hard thing as well, a whole ethical, the rules, as ambiguous as they are.
It's sort of a lifelong observance, I guess. I was raised very strict, Missouri Centralism, and was taught to be seen and not heard, and it seemed like other churches were going through that too in the Midwest where I was raised. In fact, the minister thought the catechism class had not learned what it should have, and so he had us go two more years, so I think I have a BS in catechism. In my personal life, I dropped out of the church. It just got too much. And then skipped many years coming back. I saw a different kind of a church. People getting up and they can talk, they clap in church, they laugh in church. Then everybody turns around and shakes everybody's hand and all this. But the thing, to go back, right, the growing pains or the uneasiness, it seems like after the service is over with, you're walking out and you see the same people that you have, shaken hands with or greeted or whatever, and your eyes do not meet or whatever. You get in your car and go home. And the next Sunday, you repeat the process over. It seems like we're going into a different phase that we don't know how to deal with it.
Yes?
I think in terms of our expectation of the church is something that... Well, in fact, we do have an expectation. We think that something's going to happen, that we belong to the church, and then there's some sort of a magic or something that we associate with that, so that our that we run into trouble when we're passive about that. But in fact, if we look very deeply, the fact is what our faith does is ask us for a commitment. And I think that the lack of response that people get is a lack of commitment that individual people in the congregation are failing to make. That our expectation is, and why we get disappointed, is a passive expectation. Where, in fact, we're called to be active.
Pat?
I think as church members, sometimes we forget the reason that we have joined the church. And the reasons that we join churches are diverse. And oftentimes we have a need to be met. When working on a call committee, I found that that people join the church because they need to have their child baptized. Sometimes they're looking for fellowship. So the reason people are drawn to churches are very diverse. And when they come to church and have that need met, they forget to pass it on and reach out to others. And I think that that process of reaching out to others, one of the things that have been done to us is not passed on. And I think that has to happen more in churches, to seek out individuals, to find out what their need is, and to help them. And I don't think that's done oftentimes in churches. People are afraid for some reason, or comfortable.
Well, I think, too, if the situation changes, you know, then the person is no longer felt to be welcome. Like if they were part of the church and then they get a divorce, and all of a sudden, why, there's a guilt trip laid on. And no one knows how to deal with this, and so they're just kind of marked off the rolls. And they're the ones that are hurting and needing it worse than somebody that would be a well, quote, member. And I think this is where the church falls down, is where people actually have the hurts and the needs, you know, how to handle it.
Larry?
Now, the discussion has gone to a sort of a general discussion of the church and the church as community. But I wondered if we could focus it a bit on mental illness and mental well-being. And I guess I just ask as a question without having even the beginnings of an answer. I would like us to talk a bit about what place religious faith, what place religion in our experiences, whether observed or highly personal to us, to our mental illness or our mental well-being. I mean, I don't know if Joe or Karen or someone else here has some observations to make from counseling, either professional or, you know, friend to friend or whatever. But I would like to hear a bit more focus on that topic as such.
I might just begin by restating the kind of classical in psychology anyway, a notion that Freud presented, and that was that religion and the need for an experience with God was essentially a neurotic kind of need on the part of people. That his view was that religion was a much like Marx, an opiate of the masses, that this was a way of essentially working through or reestablishing the relationship with an authoritarian figure, father figure type situation, and that all religion thus was came out of our own needs and our own infantile needs, and thus was served neurotic purposes and was not freeing. It's important to see, however, that Freud doesn't speak for the entire field of psychology or psychiatry, and that there are many others, Carl Jung in particular, who said, and I think you used this quote, Karen, earlier in a presentation, that all people, all neurotics are searching for religion. There are many other strains of thought in psychology that suggest that spiritual rightness and spiritual oneness is the pursuit and should be the pursuit of people who are moving in the direction of life satisfaction and self-development. So that just a very sketchy kind of background to respond to that point.
I think I'd like to respond as well by saying that the more that I've interacted with people in counseling, the more I've asked myself a very basic and simple question. Is this person's faith experience, positive or negative, enhancing their health, their sense of well-being? Is it helping them to say yes to the demands of life, the fact that we cannot control our life circumstances, or is it in fact crippling them? Is it a liability? Is it making it a lot tougher to cope and to meet crisis situations? I don't have some measuring stick on that, but I have seen that in the best cases, faith, this is in a general sense, religion or faith, helps people to say yes, I'll accept my circumstances and I'll move on, and I'll probably experience even some transformation. And in the worst of circumstances, religion seems to function as Joe already, said, that Freud said, this kind of dependency in it. But it's very exciting to me to see clients really making gains and using their faith as one of the tools, toward, being more satisfied or feeling more whole. That might be so vague that you can't respond, but I would be happier too if we could keep the topic more on religion and health.
You mentioned clients. Do you mean clients through the church that have come to you as a church?
Yes. Most of the largest percentage of people that I see, because I am a, quote, pastoral counselor, seek me out. They are church people. And
I would like to ask, as a lay person, not knowing very much, what do you mean by a pastoral consultant? Mm-hmm. I mean, as it applies to the church. Where does this come into the church?
Do you mean like church structure, like
yes,
what would my
uh-huh.
position be?
Yeah.
Okay. Specifically in my case, I'm a master's level counselor. The training came through theological seminary, not an ordained pastor. The reason I use the term pastoral counselor is to announce, if you will, that I am really open to dealing with issues of faith with folks, and that my training is theological more than straight sociological or psychological.
My next comment would be, how do you tie that into the Lutheran Church, the small parishes, as that type of counseling available to the normal church? We've been in a number of churches, but I don't know any of them have had a counselor per se, master's degree, this type of a situation.
On the staff,
yes,
or something?
Yes, most pastors. Yes. Many pastors I've talked to, where you come into a mental situation, might refer talking to a pastor about a member that might have a mental situation. How many have told me, well, I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not a psychologist, I can't handle that situation. How can we as lay people within a congregation do anything when we don't have any that type of background to counsel? I can agree with a lot of people here on some of the things they talked about that we could help that way, but when it comes to a mental situation, where does the church fit into that situation?
Well, I think
we don't have the people to help.
Right. I think referral is very important. I think that whatever pastor you've been under who has said, I'm not a trained psychologist and I need to refer, is a wise person. We're lucky. There's lots and lots of resources, but in a general sense, I think this is sort of a backtracking, but if all of us as lay folks felt more comfortable with hearing others' confessions or just understanding, listening, just sort of simple things like that, I think we could alleviate some major causes of mental distress.
Yeah. See, I think the man that I used in the example, just to touch on this a moment, but also try to bring the discussion back, really didn't need a psychotherapist, really didn't need his congregation to understand or to have any knowledge of what depression meant for him. What he needed was support, friendship, contact, somebody to say, we're here with you, you know, we'll pray for you, we'll visit you.
And aren't many of us lay people would like to do that, but aren't we just a little bit afraid maybe to...
Well, yeah, but that brings in, yeah, that brings in the fear aspect. That brings another point beside whether we're trained to be able to do it. I'd like to, though, make another point in connection with this business of whether or not religion or faith is healthy or unhealthy. My own personal view I'd like to share with you. I believe that faith is extremely healthy and necessary. I believe that religion can be very unhealthy for people. In the following way, at least for one example. I believe that what happens to a lot of people, and what happens to all of us in a sense, is that we come to our religion in a variety of different ways. We come to our religion from our parents, we come to our religion from our family, and to a degree we often come to our religion through our church. And that's all tied up with our faith. And what I mean by coming to our religion is that we get our faith kind of with the add-ons of the religion. And the add-ons are the attitudes and the biases and the narrow kind of tunnel visions of our parents and our families and many times our congregations, and that those, it seems to me, are often very unhealthy and contribute significantly to emotional distress in people. And yet that the potential is, of course, in the redeeming faith of a relationship with God.
Get back to, just remind us of the possible cultural relativity of the whole notion of mental well-being and mental illness. I can imagine Kierkegaard, for example, tearing his hair out at this whole discussion. We are equating mental health with lack of mental distress and assessing whether or not religion contributes to mental health by assessing whether or not it minimizes mental distress. If we are going to define mental health as lack of mental distress and as smooth social functioning, and some people analyzing what people are talking about in the mental health professions accuse it of doing nothing more than that, then we might say, well, couldn't care less whether religion contributes to mental health or not. That's not its function. Its function is not limited to making people happier. Well, enough said of that, just to call our attention to that dimension of the issue.
Well, I should be clear that, like John Sanford, I do not equate mental health with peace of mind. Mental health, for me, includes struggle. And as John Sanford said, probably Christ or Paul would be good examples of folks who did not have peace of mind. So that is not what I'm meaning to talk about when I talk about wellness or lack of distress. I think for myself, the focus would be, though, more on mental illness as a product of not being, at least in this context, talking about the church and our role, when we're not acceptable, when we're not found acceptable by a group like the church, what kind of symptoms does that produce? Which I think is a different question than whether or not a person has peace of mind or so forth.
Well, I think, you know, the entire Bible practically shows that Jesus wants us to have wholeness, and, you know, the mental health aspect, just go through the Beatitudes, that you're this and you shall be this, you know, through this, the process and the scripture. The peace that I have is not the peace that the world has. You know, for God has not given you a spirit of fear, but of love, power, and a sound mind. It's always kind of a distressing thing and this is the potential over here, you know, but reaching the potential can be a problem at times. I've been raised a Lutheran also, and I have had renewal experiences personally within my journey, and I can think of when you discuss mental health, the church, and theology, I can think of many stress situations with me regarding theology. And I think perhaps on this journey that each individual makes, and that we are in the church, there the flesh always wants acceptance, you know, in the church. I still have enough flesh to want this acceptance in the church body. So if expressing a different point of view or something, I can think of several years back of a situation where, it was a personal situation where I had a miscarriage and then went through kind of a personal experience with the Lord, which was very dear to me. And then when I went to, you know, explain this to my pastor or something, I realized that he wasn't in agreement, or, you know, and this caused distress at that point. And then with the theology behind you, you know, meshing the two together, perhaps it's a point of not being mature or whatever. But these things can cause distress, and I think as knowledge continues to increase and increase and increase, we're going to continually meet these little distress points where we have to try and mesh our thinking together. You know, and sometimes as a Lutheran, I think, my goodness, Martin Luther was a man who, if he felt, you know, that the church wasn't doing something, then he spoke up, you know, and he stood up and said or whatever, and I know he went through plenty of, you know, lots of trauma. But anyway, today it's just, you know, for a while it seemed to me, after being in about 4 Lutheran churches, that one of the themes that I've experienced is peace at all costs. You know, trying not to create, don't rock the ship, you know, or try and be nice or whatever. So that's just, I suppose, is that in keeping with your topic at all? I don't know if it is, but.
Well, I think that's very useful to hear, and I really appreciate it, because at least for myself, that's the kind of distress that I, part of the kind of distress that I think we all have experienced in the church at times.
Yes?
One of the favorite accounts of the Gospels for me is the one where the four friends bring their distressed friend, tear a hole in the roof, and let him down in the presence of Jesus. The man was paralyzed, as you recall, and is lying paralyzed in the presence of Jesus. The friends are looking down at him through the hole in the roof, waiting for Jesus to heal him. They believe that Jesus would heal him. That's why they brought him there. And Jesus looks down at the man on the floor and says, "My son, your sins, they forgive to you." And then, as the story goes, and you're all well aware of it, he does heal his physical ailment as well. But he does that, as he says, in order to show that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins. He heals him physically to show that he had power to forgive him, and that when he said, "Your sins are forgiven," that he was forgiven. But I think he also did that to show that the priority of God's grace is always to do the most important thing and meet the most important need, which apparently is the biggest healing, the healing of unforgiven sin. Now, in that light, it seems to me that when we think of the church's healing ministry, we should realize that it has every Sunday the opportunity for people to confess their sins and to be encouraged in the liturgy to believe their sins are forgiven, and that this is the biggest need for healing that people have, whether they know it or not, and that it is the biggest healing that's being done in the world every Sunday and every day of the week. I think we should start with that when we think about the church and wholeness and mental and spiritual health, because that's the healing business of the church, which the church is supposed to major in, and which is not really the primary task of other caring and healing persons and agencies in such a direct sense. But I think that is a perspective that we need to keep in mind. And I think another thing that comes to mind in relation to what I heard Maurer say some years ago, and he's been working at a little debate with him about 15 years ago. The impression that I got from him is that he assumes that all the people he meets are illustrations of the total condition of the church, and the church therefore never does any good for anybody. Whereas I tried to point out to him, how about all the people that never come to see you because of what the church did for them?
Wes?
Yes.
I'd like to follow on the gentleman's comment. Confession of sins and forgiveness. In the New Testament, it seems to me, is also always linked with our relationship to one another. That the forgiveness which we are given is intended to come from God, but come from one another and be extended to one another. I'm reminded of that in the Lord's Prayer and in numerous other places. I've been wondering why the discussion tonight, the topic of which was the influence of the relationship between mental health, religion on mental health, has constantly flown back to the experience of our churches, and why, what is the lack our churches, what is the state of our churches. And maybe that's appropriate because the lack in, if a church body lacks the quality of confessing and forgiving known and extended through one another, and if a person in that body knows nothing of love and acceptance extended through the members of that body to one's life. If a church is the sort of place where you go for 7 years and don't even get spoken to, then it's evident that the church is going to be contributing nothing to one's sense of mental well-being. And that the issue of and that in fact the real question is, it isn't perhaps so theoretical, what is the relationship of mental between religion and mental health, but it is more practical. What is the kind of life we experience within this which we call the body of Christ? And if even more so, the gospel calls us to a stance of not adjustment to society, but to in many ways a holy maladjustment to society, then all the more reason that within that body we find that kind of support and acceptance, because we will need it all the more.
I would like to pick up Joe's point real briefly again, too. I think that there really is, we're really talking about two things. One is how individual or personal faith operates to enhance our mental health, or whatever it is that we're now talking about, and how one's organized religious life affects one's mental health. And sometimes it seems like those things are just not integrated well enough. the sense of formal religion and church that, you know, people are giving a lot of, you know, sort of sad stories tonight about their experiences and their disappointments in their church. I think we also bear individual responsibility as Christians for how we as adults make our faith work for us positively. I don't think the whole burden is whether or not our fellowship is supportive, though I think that is best and that is the way, in my opinion, it was meant to be. But where can we become more responsible in our own faith journeys for our mental health, if you will?
I like the expression from the professional a little bit with reference to if they can digress on it. Their clients, when they come to them, do they have faith or don't they have faith?
I'm not sure I caught that.
Asking whether or not the clients who come to
these clients, as you would be,
do they have faith or don't they?
Psychiatric care, do they have faith or?
Some do and some don't. Some do and some don't. Some gain it, some lose it.
I'd like to respond to that because the parish that I happen to be the pastor of seeks to serve in the central city, and a great share of that are what a lot of other people call crazies. And they've been in and out of institutions and, you know, years and years lived on the streets. I would say the greatest percentage of them have faith. And I think it's, for me, it's delightful to serve a parish that feels no need to condemn any of those people for wherever they are in terms of their mental condition or they're crazy or anything. And because they don't feel a need to condemn, it is not hard for them to give the message to what some of the people call these crazies and do crazy things, that God forgives them because they're already experiencing it through somebody making them a cup of coffee or finding them some food or finding them some clothes or giving them a bed for the night. And I think the church here, and I guess I feel terribly fortunate because we've got so many poor and crazies and we have a tremendous advantage. I think we're terribly rich in that. And I think some of these people, in terms of what society says, or even the professionals say, in terms of becoming, you know, devoid of symptoms, they will never. They've been in it 20 years, or some of them 30 years, and they've learned to live under porches and bridges, and they survive, but they have faith. And there's an awful lot of love, and there's a system there, and the church becomes a part of it, where there may not be quite as much correctness as there is in the churches, but maybe there's even more love. And a kind of healing that makes existence and bearing both joy and sorrow possible.
Thank you for saying what I want to say, but couldn't get it out.
One more comment.
I just want to say that I have personally experienced a lot of positive things in my church and through the people in it and through our pastor to help me in my mental health, plus to reach out to others. I remember when we first joined, one of the things in a small group I heard is that they had done a study and they with a group of psychiatric patients, and half of them went to a trained counselor and got help, and the other half went to trained housewives who happened to have the time to listen to them, and they got just as well as the other one. And he gave us some help in how to listen to people. And he has incorporated many of these things in his sermons and in small groups. And I find that that has become a part of my life, just from hearing it over the years, that I don't think so much in my church, but when I go out other places, many times things will come to me that, hey, this is helpful for somebody. And I think this is something that we can all do more of it, but it's something that we've stressed a little bit on the negative today, and I think there are a lot of good things happening, even though we would like to see more things going that way.
I think that's part of the reason that I like to emphasize the charism that is given to the church, that all of us as lay people can certainly become good listeners, and that must be 25%, if not larger, of the battle.
Thank you very much.